Yeah. So, without any further ado, let's get this show on the road. Take it away, Jason.
Okay. Thanks, Henry. Hey, thanks for joining us at what feels really early, to me at least. My name's Jason Epping. I'm the curator of digital media here, and this is the fourth year that we've been working with IndieCade to put together IndieCade East. I hope you guys have had a great first couple days so far. To my immediate right is GJ Lee. To her right is Brian. Yes, Brian Chung, and then Sam Roberts all the way at the end. Do you guys want to say a little bit?
Yeah, everybody should
say what you
something about.
Yeah,
things.
Please introduce yourself.
Or tell us your cat's name.
My cat's name is Sheep. So hello, I'm GJ, festival co-chair along with Brian. Helped curate the third floor. Hope you guys all enjoyed what's up there. That's my introduction.
Sure. Like GJ said, we worked together on curating the third floor throughout the year. We also teach game design and development, and we work on our own games outside of that. We also curate a lot of showcases throughout the year with our organization, the Sheep's Meow, in the New York City and New Jersey area.
And your cat is also named Sheep, right?
Yes.
Same That's cat. Where the name came from, right?
Yeah.
Oh, God, It's, to be fair to me, it's like 8 a.m. on a Sunday because I'm from the West Coast. So, I'm Sam Roberts. I'm the festival director for IndieCade. I also teach and do curricular stuff at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And I make games and run around and shout at people. Mostly I run around and shout at people, so you may have seen me doing that. and the four of us worked together with a couple of other members of the team to curate the exhibit on the third floor. I think, yeah, I'm going to take this away.
Run the show, Sam, please.
I've got a structure, so this isn't going to be all rambling, I promise. The first thing I'd like to do is let's just take a second, and I'm going to read this curation statement, which we have put up here twice. But the two things are the same, even though they are not identically sized windows or positioned the same. So, the strange arcade. The creative act frequently resists the constraints from which it is born. For designers of games and interactive experiences, the challenge of creating experiences that are both expressive and replicable has proved a productive tension, resulting in unique controllers, unusual displays, and novel interactions that incite curiosity and undermine expectations. Strange Arcade features dozens of games and experiences that use costume controllers, embedded media technologies, reappropriated consumer devices, and other subverted technologies to create strange play performances and explore new ways of sharing stories. We worked on that together. I think it turned out pretty good. So that's the frame for our exhibit this year. And I'd actually like to start the panel by having each curator reflect for a minute on that frame and maybe talk about one game in the third floor exhibit that they think exemplifies what we were going for, at least from their point of view. I'll start. Yay! Because by starting, I get to take the easy one. Line Wobbler is amazing. Right? Okay. So, I don't know how many of you have been to the third floor. I love to make you raise your hands. So why don't we all raise our hands if we've been up to the third floor? Yay! That's everybody. And have we all seen Line Wobbler? Yeah. So Line Wobbler is amazing. And it is two very simple pieces of over-the-counter technology. There's nothing unique or very special or hard to get about them. You don't have to be some crazy technologist to know that they make ropes now that have lights in them. That joystick, the Wobble joystick, is 35 years old as a piece of technology at that point. It's better now than it once was, but they're very old pieces of technology. Line Wobbler, to me, is essentially, so we're looking at a bunch of different ideas here, and it is both an unusual display because it's using the single rope light, but most importantly, what Robin Baumgartner, who's the designer, has done is they've taken a familiar and comfortable play experience, something that as game designers we know well, maybe, and has a very recognizable play loop, right? So Robin regularly describes the game as a one-dimensional dungeon crawler. right? And we know most of us probably what a dungeon crawler is. You have a little hero, and you venture into a dungeon, and floor by floor you conquer monsters, and you avoid traps, and as you advance deeper, you grow in power and capability, right? And there's a bunch of comfortable, very old-school design to that. We know how to make that play loop feel pretty good. So Robin took on the constraint, though, of how do we do all of this stuff that's normally represented in a 2D or 3D environment with a lot of statistics and graphical feedback, and boil that down to basically a single string of lights and some beautiful audio feedback and a simple but really compelling input device. The second constraint that Robin has is this wobble controller, right? And actually, what's wonderful about the wobble controller is there's only one thing that you can use to interface. You're not watching a whole HUD. You don't have six buttons or any of that. But because of the sort of looseness to it, you can develop an expertise around how you handle that joystick. And just by boiling all the output into this one light string and all the input into this loose but specific controller, he managed to recapture the game loop and the joy and the sort of compelling nature of the play of a dungeon crawler inside this very simple experience. And to me, this is actually a brilliant piece of design. That game also, I happen to know, was heavily iterated on and playtested. Robin spent a lot of time making sure it felt very, very, very good. So to me, this is just a beautiful example of how a designer can look at the world around them and say, okay, so we all love to play games. Games are amazing. And right now, I see a lot of games that are played with a controller on a screen. And why does it have to be an Xbox controller? And why does the screen have to be 1280 by 720? What's the HD?
1920 by 1080.
1920 by 1080. Thank you, Museum of the Movie and Image Curator. right, but why do those have to be the way we present games? And to me, this is the joy and excitement of the Strange Arcade. It's like taking a look at all of the things available to us in the world and saying, how can we make play experiences that take advantage of these other technologies, these other presentation formats, these other inputs? How can we find play in the world around us? And I think this is actually the future of play and digital play as we move forward 10, 20, 30 years. We're going to be finding ways to embed play all around the world and inside things that are not just computers. So that's why I love Line Wobbler, and it's why it's an important part of the exhibit to me.
When we were in the early stages of talking about the curation statement and writing it out, I think one of the things that that we talked about a lot was about there's a line in there about the tension between the theme of a game and its affordances. And so Line Wobbler is on one kind of extreme end of that spectrum. All the games in this curation are sort of lie somewhere along that spectrum. So I guess in comparison to Line Wobbler, on the sort of other extreme end is Butt Sniffing Pugs, which is very heavily on the theme side, right? So you have these oversized tennis balls, which are like if you think about the size of a tennis ball to a pug, this oversized tennis ball is like a similar ratio to a human size. And it's too big for your hand, so you can't like really grip it, so you kind of like clumsily paw at it, right? Like a pug. And the way the park is designed and the sort of the inaccuracy of the device that's built into it, you kind of amble around in an indirect way a lot. And the sort of the game has its tasks and objectives, but you find yourself in different parts of the park in a non-linear way, and it's all kind of clumsy and kind of captures that, you know, being a pug in a park.
I think I would love us to talk a little to each other too, right? So I also think it's amazing because of that clumsiness and just simply because of the way that the interface device is laid out and stuff. Look, you know, you get to sniff the other pug's butts by pressing the stuffed pug butt controller, right? However, if you're like playing it and getting into it and starting to feel the pug and you're running your hands on the thing, the way that feels natural to sniff the other pug's butt every time is to shove your face into the stuffed controller, which is, you know, that's what pugs are doing. They're shoving their faces into each other's butts. And, like, that's subtle, I guess, you know. You don't think about the fact that there are specific design choices being made to encourage you to do that. But that's something that I think when you're talking about this connection between theme and interface that a lot of the games on the third floor are doing. And I think Butt Sniffing Pugs is doing it brilliantly.
To kind of add to that, I think the ratio for, like, a regular tennis ball to a pug is kind of equivalent to that glorious tennis ball size to human. So there's kind of, like, this weird, nice analogy that connects the two. What was the question again?
The curation statement.
Okay.
What it means to you in a game. Identifies it.
Okay. It's kind of hard to isolate a single game because all the games kind of work together in a way. They've all been laid out in such a way that they complement one another. I want to say Hurt Me Plenty. It's kind of nice because you're using the leap in probably the most incorrect way possible, but it's the most, it's like the only way you should be using that machine, I think. And because it deals with something serious in like an underlying humorous way, it like the way it subverts the theme that it's trying to capture, I think it's done very well. And so, yeah. Kind of nice. Sorry that it's behind a screen. But like,
sorry.
But what I think kind of works really well that it's behind a screen is that you have these moments where like people are peeking through those like areas just to kind of see what's going on. There's something that adds to that. Kind of seeing something a little naughty behind these little spaces that ended up working really well.
Yeah, that was a requirement from the museum's end because we have lots of young impressionable parents who come through. And so, yeah, we just needed to put up a, you know, equivalent of a trigger warning to let them know what they're walking into first. But I agree. We had to do that last year, too, and I think it actually makes it more naughty in a really funny way.
No, see these, like, women with, like, children, and they're, like, kind of, like, seeing what's going on. They're like, okay, it's like, for a second. And then they, like, walk past and then come back later when their like, kids are busy playing Line Wobbler or something. I think that's
the way
pretty
it locks
nice.
You out.
Yeah. Oh, and also the way the game locks you out. Yeah, the game locks you out, so you have to like hard reset it. So we have to frequently come back because people are really rough, and it's heartbreaking at the same time. Like, what do you expect?
Well,
I think what's great about that is that it also there's this other thing that it also subverts the idea of what a program on your computer is that you can execute it whenever you want, however you want, and you know you don't have to treat it nice, right? Mm-hmm. And it kind of subverts that expectation too of what a computer program is.
Well, because I mean, there's the issue of incentives, right? Like, what's the consequences of violating a safe word? So if you don't know, there's a safe word. You're given, you know, if how hard you can, how much you can spank this person. And if they say their safe word, you have to stop. And if you don't, then you get locked out for like 3 weeks, right?
Yeah, it's forever. It's
yeah, forever.
Not
you can't play the game for another 3 weeks if you sort of violated it. So like, subverts it in that way, and it subverts like incentive and all that sort of stuff. Because I mean, I think a lot of people play inside these games because they can sort of act out. You get to act out. There's no consequences. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any of the Grand Theft Auto series, for example, like you get to sort of explore these fantasies of doing these terrible things, and there's no consequences. And I love how it subverts that.
And I think, I mean, all the things you're saying, one of the things that's great about Hurt Me Plenty, and I think also really fits into some of the stuff we're looking at here, is it's very deliberately designed to sort of layer these subversions on top of each other so that they end up commenting on each other, right? So that subverting the core purpose of the controller, it subverts in some levels the content, right? Typically a game that features sort of naked people and butt slapping and things like that would be erotic, and the game is very deliberately presented in a non-erotic way. It's funny. It's not sexy. And then, it subverts. Like, it's like, no, I'm a program on your computer, but you have to be nice to me, not treat me, you know, the way that people treat, I don't know, what's a program that people abuse? Microsoft Word? I think those end up actually building on one another in a very interesting way. They become part of these sort of like constraints and affordances for the game, and they have this interlocking. I think that design is really impeccable in that way. Robert spoke yesterday.
Yes.
That's sad. I would tell you all to go today if it was today, but you missed it if you didn't see it.
And I believe it was made for a competition by the creators, and I guess they weren't happy or whatever, but it's kind of
leap
like...
For a leap motion.
Yeah.
And
that's
exactly what they're looking for.
And I think like it's kind of brilliant how it was made for that, and it's like exactly what they don't want, but like it was made anyway, and it's like this is the best thing for it.
Yeah, and there was a great deal of tension around that contest. The company that made the device that wanted GameSport was like, oh, no, this is not what we wanted. And then basically everyone else who wasn't in that company was like, this is the best thing that was made in the... you understand that this is the one that's good, right? This is the good one? They're like, no, that's not good. Time travel through your hands. Oh, okay. Although that game is pretty good.
I'm having a hard time deciding between Tripad and Codex Bash, and I think they both are very similar in a funny way. What's that?
I love them.
Yeah, no, they're fantastic. And I think the reason I group them together is they're both sort of like re-envisioning sort of these toys from the late 80s through the late 90s, like Bop It and Simon Says and all those sorts of things. Those are, I guess, later, but that the whole sort of lineage of games. I mean, Tripad's amazing in that it solves this issue of three players, which was really cool, and the balance of that game is just really brilliant and really simple. And also that it's sort of thought of as a platform and not just as one game.
Yeah, there are multiple games actually that he's designed I believe. Right. Are we running the soccer game upstairs?
He calls it Gladiator.
Yeah, that's the soccer game. Yeah. It's really good.
Yeah, and then, and, you know, Codex Bash is effectively sort of like a Simon in that, you know, you have to sort of decode and remember a series of instructions, but what's interesting about it is he explodes it into space, and so as a result, you know, you're having to communicate and run around. You're sort of fighting the clock. And what's great also about that game is, you know, it could take up 10 square feet, it could take up 100 square feet or more. And what's interesting is that itself defines a lot of the mechanics and a lot of the play.
Go ahead, GJ.
To kind of add on to that, I was talking to Alistair, who was the developer behind it. And it's placed actually in a very specific area in the museum, third floor. It's by an entrance towards another section of the third floor, and it's done purposely so that it kind of blurs the line between like people who are actually playing and people who are just passing through, who can kind of just like press a button and just carry on with their way around the floor, because it blurs those lines between player and spectator, and I think that's really interesting, because a lot of the games. To go with part of the curation statement was to incite curiosity. And curiosity kind of is a nice word that like lowers the barrier to like entry to a lot of games. Mm-hmm. I think also to do that, like to have it in a space where people are bound to just like walk through and invade and all that stuff and just kind of like boop and that's it. I think that's kind of nice how it invites that.
Codex Bash is very fluid.
Yeah.
And it's perfect for that space. You start with one player just doing the simple colors, and then sometimes you will see that player kind of recruiting other players into it, and then maybe you start losing some members, and what you say about people passing through and stuff.
Yeah, every time I've played, somebody's had to quit halfway through, and we've dragooned someone else to join our team. I think what's really interesting about it, too, you're talking about how you could lay it out at 10 feet or 100 feet, and we chose to put it near the door because that... But what's really interesting to me about that is it's, again, on some level a platform. There's like a bunch of small little games he's playing through it, but... what Alistair's done is he's created some basic input devices and structures and these sort of like secret codes and the way he delivers them, and then uses that to create different affordances by the way he installs it in physical space, which I think is really, really interesting. Like it changes as a game and it provides different opportunities to play and different ways to play it depending on how you lay that out. When we showed it at West, there was less space between it, and the clue sheets then got sort of like passed around more, and it became much more this like communication timing game, whereas here there's a little more space and it's a little bit more of like come on everybody, like you need a leader. It's just very interesting to me how there's an open design space that can be refitted to anywhere you choose to present it and changes the experience of the game.
And the puzzles themselves are kind of nicely designed in that, like, I'm not a big puzzle person. I usually get frustrated very easily and kind of quit very early. But they're like just enough so that like anybody that's really bad at puzzles like me can kind of solve them or get some help from another person, just like ask anybody just passing around. to help, and he speaks on that, that he was very like careful with the way he designed those puzzles so that they're very approachable and challenging just enough, which I imagine is quite a design challenge for him.
I think it's also just important to note that the technology behind it is very simple. It's four wireless buttons. Mm-hmm. And that's
big buttons.
Big that are very appealing, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's really interesting that he designed this really complex game around that really simple technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff like that up there. We have a next topic we're going to move to, but I want to skip it and move to the third topic because now we've used that word a couple of times, and we should totally talk about affordances right now. Who in the audience knows what we mean when we say affordances? Okay, I see four hands. So for the rest of you, sorry, apologize that we've been using the word. I'm going to attempt to define it right now, and I'm going to be wrong. But then we're going to talk about it, and that should hopefully start to give you a better sense of what we mean. Affordances are, this is the thing I always do. This is a phone. Many of you have them in your pockets. It's a modern smartphone. It comes with a bunch of different affordances that I, as a designer making software for it, can access, and I can choose which ones to eventually provide as affordances to a user, right? So a phone has a touch screen. It can take touch input, both taps and swipes. Those are different affordances. It's got GPS, so I can grab data about where you are. It's got a speaker, so I can give audio output. It's got a screen, so I can give visual output. It's got one, two, three, four buttons that I can choose to use and make buttons that it does stuff with. It's got an accelerometer in it, so it knows if I'm waving it around. It's got several forms of near-field communication, so it can talk to other devices. And I'm probably forgetting about a couple of affordances. For instance, it's flat, so I could use it as a coaster. I don't know. but actually, this is the trick about designing in affordances, is really smart designers are finding affordances in things that you didn't know are there. And when we talk about designing and what the affordances of a platform are, or of a technology are, or of an input device are, this is what we're talking about. What are the different ways I can leverage this to provide input into the system, to connect the interface between the human being and the computer? And that's what an affordance basically is. Did I mostly get that right? Do you guys have something to add to that?
Yeah, please. I think so. I mean, I think that coming from a different perspective, because this was a term that was invented in the mid last century of a designer.
Yep. And not for specifically computers.
Yeah, specifically about design. I mean, I think another way to think about it is like no object is neutral, right?
Yep.
Every object has affordances, ways that we interact with them, or that, and for like the way it was first described to me is like. Sometimes they're very evident, and sometimes they're not.
Yep.
The affordances of a hammer are very evident, I think, to most people, and that you kind of pick it up and you understand immediately what you need to do with it. And so it's about a lot of design is about unlocking those affordances or understanding those affordances.
Highlighting usability, right? Like a doorknob, it affords turning, right? And a push plate affords pushing the door open, whereas a handle affords pulling it open. Crank tank, right? Mm-hmm. It has these big wooden wheels with these taped down handles. It's really obvious what you're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to turn it one way or the other. Line wobbler has this springy thing. You're supposed to springy it or wobble it.
The way that is obvious and part of its design, but like the minute you step up, the line leads right to a thing that's sticking up. And it's set at a sort of delicacy level, so the second you touch it, it wiggles. And then it's telling you, oh, wiggle me, please. Don't you want to be wiggled? Or don't I want to be wiggled? I lost that there at the end. But, yeah.
No, you're like effective design almost gives agency to the object.
Yeah.
And so that you don't need to read an instruction sheet. You can immediately walk up to something, understand how it's supposed to be used, and it's a very neutral, transparent process.
One of the games that does that really well upstairs, so well that it's actually, Jenny and Alec have been really good sports about it, but Stellar Smooch, yoga ball edition. It's this giant round yoga ball that's all bouncy and beautiful and like, has the cutest face ever. It has two giant buttons on either side of its head. So like, kids see it and they're like, boof! And then you see the thing flying and they've had to like rewire it so many times. But Yes, affordance is done too well. It's kind of devastating for cute faces.
Yeah, my 14 and a half month old was obsessed with it, even when it was not working. Someone had broken it just before, and she was just like, eh, eh, eh. Yeah, I know that you want to touch the adorable face that floats in midair.
I think if we're talking about the games up there and how they work with or around affordances, I think one that's really interesting to point out is Dreams. Mm-hmm. That's the one that's in the corner and low to the ground and has a vagina controller. And we were talking with the creator, and she was talking about how controllers, typical game controllers, are very phallic. Through whether it's joystick or analog sticks or line wobbler, yeah. it's just, you know, this thing that you grab, and there it is. But the controller for Dreams it subverts that. It's
Yannick.
It's soft and velvety, and there's just a just a switch, like under like a little hood, and the way you use this controller in that game, it's kind of very slow paced. It's not like this joystick on an arcade cabinet where you're gonna have a very high APM on it, so to speak. It's just this thing that you're very gentle and soft with. And
when Brian says APM, he means actions per minute.
Yeah, a lot of care seems to have gone into making that controller. Even the materials, I mean, I think she could have just easily made it with, like, flat-looking cotton fabric, but it's made with velvet, so, like, visually it's very soft, and then holding it, it's very soft, and it's quite nice to hold.
I also like to think about, and it's interesting, so Masks, which is up there, is a virtual reality game where the virtual reality helmet is embedded in this amazing cardboard house that you have to wear. And the size and bulk of that house and the sort of, like, moment of transformation that comes on when you put on the mask, which, like, theater artists have been talking about for 500 years, and there's a bunch of theory about that we don't need to go into, right? But those actually end up becoming affordances, and they tell and force the player to engage with the game in different ways. And if you watch people playing it, it's like there's this immediate... You know, people very naturally, when they pop in VR, they want to look around, but... there's parallel to it immediately this sense that they are performing for everyone around. And you can see it when you watch people play the game, and it's part of putting this giant thing on their head and thinking about how it's being positioned and try not to hit anyone with it because it's, like, sort of large and unwieldy. And, like, those aren't, again, they're like, subtler affordances of the experience and of the controller. They're not necessarily right out there. And they are not, like... If you talk about classic design from the second part of the 20th century, you would never leverage an affordance to make something harder or difficult. But to go back to this connection between theme and controller, when we're designing for a game and we're trying to make the interface or the input or the way you approach the game sort of metaphorically closer to the activity you're engaged in as a player, that suddenly the idea that you could use an affordance to make something hard becomes very compelling and helps you create experiences that you might not otherwise be able to create.
Mm-hmm. Well, to add on a bit about Mask, Laura, we were classmates actually at ITP, so I know a little bit about, like, the design process of that particular mask. It's based on kind of, like, isolation. She's not from the U.S. She came to school from China, I believe. China or Taiwan, I'm sorry. And so it deals with homesickness. It deals with isolation and how she kind of, like, not as... It's just kind of her own little, like, I don't know, anecdote about it. The video inside it, if you've seen it, it's a video of her mom and her cat. It's like a Skype conversation. And it's in Chinese, so, like, most people who have seen it or heard it, they can't understand. It's only her that she'd understand what's the conversation about. And also, like, if she's wearing it, it's a house particularly for, like, it's a house because if she wears it, it's her house, right? And if anyone else wears it, it's, like, a stranger in her house who's seeing these things that, like, from the inside looking out into the world. And what's interesting is, like, that odd kind of, sorry to touch upon that, dramatic, but, like, a player and performance kind of thing, but if someone else wears it, it's, like, everyone's kind of looking at them as an outsider. And so she kind of translates that into this, like, giant house, which is very well made. If you see it, it's very detailed. There's a lot of like little stairs on the outside, very carefully cut out, and little like window openings. A lot of care has taken was taken into making that, and kind of using also the fact that like it's a phone, right? It's used to connect people, and yet she was using it to kind of deal with the fact that like she doesn't see her family often or like communicates well across the giant sea or ocean.
I have a sort of bigger picture thing to talk about with affordances, which is so as the curator of digital media, I'm always sort of dealing with this tension of what does it mean to put digital things in a physical space? Like why almost anything that isn't the purview of my subject matter is something that you can probably encounter online at this point. And so why, what does it bring to an audience, or what value is there in collecting those things in a physical space? And I'm really, really proud of the showcase that we put together this year, because I think it answers a lot of those questions for me, in that we're gathering a lot of games and experiences that this is the kind of space or the kind of gathering that really accentuates them. Because, you know, you think about, not that this should not be done, and I have done it in some ways, but like putting a bunch of games that you can just get on Steam in a physical space with just a bunch of Xbox or PlayStation controllers, like what is interesting about that? I mean, briefly, the way that I answer that question is I'm looking at three things. I'm looking at sort of the community that can be brought around something. I'm thinking about the context that placing those things comes in. I forgot my third criteria at the moment. But so there's like two right now. Three things usually that I'm thinking about when I'm doing that. So it's really early, sorry, for me. These games are and experiences are really great in that way, in that this a physical space where often, I think what's also important is that the creators are present, mm-hmm. Too, and so it becomes more of an event in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great transition to talk about some of the stuff we want to talk about. I actually was very uninvolved in this part this year, but when I finally got here and was walking through as we were starting to install stuff upstairs, the flow through the space and the choice of where every game went was, to me, impeccable this year. The three of you sort of worked on that together, but mostly Brian and GJ did that, right? Yeah. I would love for you guys, any one of you, to jump in and talk about that process for this year.
Sure. So I guess starting from the beginning, we were thinking about, the first thing, like going up through those white stairs, what should the first thing people see be? And that's important because it would kind of set the tone of what people might expect out of what else is on the floor. And when we're looking through the list of, Crank Tank just immediately came to mind because we just wanted people to go up and just be surprised, right? Mm-hmm. Just to see people crouching down, cranking away at this thing and see that there's these unusual kind of high energy, kinesthetic kind of thing out front, and then they can walk into the rest with kind of primed with like a certain attitude. And then I guess in that room, we had, we thought of Line Wobbler in the center, sort of as a, almost like a navigational landmark, almost like a,
a beacon.
Yeah, it's like, if any of you do level design, like you probably think about this kind of stuff too. And the way that people, Line Wobbler is a one player game, but you know, people spectate it 360 degrees around. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit before about Codex Bash and its fluidity and how that would be kind of positioned near two entrances, but also as sort of a counterpoint to Line Wobbler, which is like one strong focus point in the middle that has people around it, and Codex Bash kind of spreads out in four directions or more. And these are the kind of things that like we thought about, where to position the things that are more spectacles that people would spectate, because some of them are sort of the opposite. They're kind of like more immersive, right? Like ICU or Nevermind.
Your anamorphic agency.
Right. So we spaced those out. If you look through through the gallery, those are kind of spaced out, almost alternating. Mm-hmm. And some other considerations, like along the long hallway, there's this really long sight line. So we thought a lot about verticality also, which games are seated. And then you have like Vec9, where people are standing. We talked about Crank Tank, where people are crouching or kneeling. And so we were just thinking about the gallery from all sorts of angles and what you would see if you were looking down one line, or what you would hear or see when you turn around the corner, and just think about movement and flow, and where you want people to kind of stay and stagnate, and where you want people to move on.
Yeah, for some reason I never end up talking about it that way, but like when you said level design, I was like, oh yeah, right, because it is. It's a piece of level design. You're trying to direct people through physical space based on layout and make some places more or less attractive or accommodate groups for watching or allow for isolation and immersion. So.
Yeah, I think.
I just wanted to bring up, I think it's important to understand the constraints that we're working inside of too, which is like using existing furniture that we have and existing technology and like just sort of being like, oh, here's how many projectors that are available. Here's like the number of desks and chairs that we have available.
You were wonderful, by the way.
Oh.
Helping with all that.
Cheers, thank you. Thanks.
Jason is wonderful. It's okay.
we can all agree on that. I think that working inside of those constraints is kind of challenging, at least from an exhibition management perspective. Like, that's not usually how we're thinking about things. Like, usually, so all that and also turning around in 5 days, basically, is like an extraordinary feat for something that looks as good as it does. So I just want to bring that up. And other thing I want to talk about was something we did new this year, which I really liked, and maybe this is like really like nuts and bolts logistics, but I thought it was really interesting, was working in a Google drawing to map the thing.
Yeah.
So one of the other constraints that we have is we're just on calls all the time. We're never meeting in the space, really. And so on these constant calls, it was like really, really interesting that we could all be looking at the same document and dragging something around and sort of do that collaboratively. I thought that was really cool.
The collaboration tools are great.
Yeah, setting up expectations was a very important thing for us because we wanted to make sure to like kind of honor the space. I mean, we're in a museum, and even if the festival is going on, a lot of the attendees were general audiences. So we wanted to make sure that early on they knew what kind of showcase it was, and which is why Crank Tank is one of the first things. Again, I think I said it before about how curiosity is a big thing. Because it is, it helps lower the barrier. A lot of people, when they see games, they're like, "I don't play games," or like they see a controller and they get very intimidated by it. But if an expectation is set in the beginning that like that there's going to be like strange things here, there's going to be things that will draw you to, I don't know, experiences that like you haven't seen before or witnessed. It's more inviting that way, and so. Yeah, we really wanted to make sure that was kind of like set in the beginning because we wanted everyone to enjoy the showcase.
I think setting moods for different kind of mood in each room was something that was thought about a lot. And towards the entrance, having as you say, there are little kids coming through. Crank Tank, Codex Bash, Line Wobbler, and Ziff. Kind of we thought of. We didn't want anybody to be turned away by a lot of, more serious-looking video games, right? Video games. So, like, the mood of each room, we kind of wanted to kind of set, all the way on the right, you had Anamorphic Agency and Masks and Dreams, these kind of more... they all just have a particular mood to them. And then there's Hotaru around the corners. And I think one last thing is one of the latest decisions that was made was, like, on your way out, there's the Little Happies photo booth. So it's like when you go out to, like, an event, it's kind of like, you know, you take photos, right, mm-hmm. to as sort of as on your way out to the elevator.
All right, I'm going to move on to the next topic. I was going to maybe talk just about really nuts and bolts part of our process, but I'm not sure that that's interesting. Wow. See, yeah, we talked for... I've been talking slowly. I think that's helped. I'll take 2 minutes real quick. I mean, so I really enjoy every year when we do East. It's a real group curation. And we've tried it different ways. But this year was just very organic. We sort of worked together and found a theme. And that theme actually came because we wanted to be able to link what we were doing in the exhibit to some of the talks and speakers that were coming. And then we all sort of went into this generative phase where everybody was like, oh, this is a cool thing that fits in theme, I think. And we just started adding games to this sort of big group spreadsheet we were all looking at and writing in comments about them. Oh, I like this. Oh, I don't know about this. Does this really fit? And we're all sort of coming from... we're all curating other things all the time, right? So I think everybody is pulling a little from their prior curations. You know, I always start the East curation by saying, here's, you know, like the stuff that was at West that might fit. And then we found developers who we thought were going to be in the conference, who had applied through conference submissions, who might have appropriate content. Like, what are their games going to fit? What are they talking about? How do we add that? As we continued on, I know even, like, some of us were stumbling across games in February and March and, like, sending an email that was like, oh, my God, I just found this, and we should all be looking at it and put it in the curation. And it was this, like, back-and-forth conversation whittling. What do these things fit together? Which of these developers are going to be able to come? Which of these developers, is it going to be too much to get the game here or have the game fit in the space, or is it going to be hard to have them travel? And we just sort of, you know, it's that, like, stupid chip away at the rock till you find the statue. It was like we had this mass of, like, ideas, and slowly we whittled it down till it sort of was the exhibit that I think we had all thought about. It's a messy way to describe the process, but I'd love for any of the three of you guys to respond or talk about what you felt worked really well out of that or didn't this year.
I just briefly want to respond to that last thought, which is I've always sort of thought of the curatorial process not as a process of inclusion, but a process of exclusion,
mm-hmm.
of, like, here's the whole world. And
what doesn't belong.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. In telling a story.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that how our brains work anyways, right? This is like a stupid brain psychology thing that's probably been disproven since we're changing all of our science about it all the time. But as far as I know, the last time I was reading this stuff, we're constantly pulling in vastly more information than we can process. And actually a huge part of the development of human consciousness, all that stuff, is our brains going through this process of figuring out what information to throw out so that we can process the amount that's left and make use of it.
I think what's interesting, or one thing that's interesting, is that this all started, like this whole theme and everything, started with the idea of tying the curation upstairs more closely with what's going on downstairs in the conferences. And it totally started that way, but it ultimately just became about what, you know, what would feel good in a museum setting, mm-hmm. in that space upstairs. And
I think on that note, I mean, this is like an obvious thing to say, but, like, the games that you show should be, like, fun to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a sort of bit of self-reflection about last year, I think that we didn't hit that mark all the time. And I think that, at least I was very adamant that, like, that needs to be a criteria, that we couldn't show a game just because there was something intellectually interesting about it, that it had to also be an enjoyable experience.
Fight fun enjoyable, but it had to be an experience.
An experience, right.
Yeah, I think a diversity of experiences, like, There's a lot of humor, like runs through a lot of the games here, but there's also a lot of like the serious, right?
Totally.
And
mixing all of that up. The effective experience.
Yeah, yeah. There's quite a bit of horror and trauma upstairs too, right?
Sure.
Nevermind, Anamorphic, and ICU all sort of fit that. So, but they're clearly distinct experiences that audiences are interested in. So.
Yeah, like the comment about how like it's a process of excluding projects, but doing that and making sure you're careful about it includes a lot of people to come, right? And so I think that is really important because it's a museum. You want people to enjoy, as much people to enjoy. And so, yeah, that's something that we were really careful about, or yep. We tried our best to be careful about.
That's an important, that's an important point that Indiecade in L.A. Has a different audience perspective because you're not also inviting a general public. As a museum, we're open to the general public, and they're invited to come up to the third floor. So, yeah, there's a different way we have to think about that.
Yeah, there is a public audience for the core exhibit in L.A., but not the rest of the event. So the core exhibit is
right.
It's almost different. Here, people come to the event and then move through the event to the third floor, which needs to be inviting to the public but also linked to the stuff that they've been seeing.
But people aren't otherwise coming to the firehouse. Yeah. To see a movie or something.
Right. They're not coming there for other reasons. They're
right.
They're going to the firehouse to see those games. Then if those games are exciting or curious or inviting enough, they are sort of become paths that lead into the rest of the festival. Sure. And that is, it's a different design challenge when you're talking about what goes in and what doesn't. I also think I just, you know, so much to me, and this is what GJ is talking about a little, of what's important about Indiecade is the idea of inclusion, a diversity of voices and a diversity of experiences for a diverse audience of people. We're not just serving one specific audience. We want different kinds of people to find different kinds of things to do there. And it's actually, even though that sounds opposed to this idea that curation is about excluding things, if you start from the basis of what Jason said, it enables it very easily. It's like everything is on the table, and now I will start to pull stuff out until I have the right thing that's left. And because you start with everything, it's easy to have stuff from a wider variety of places, I think. And so that's I love the way that you describe that. We have like just two more minutes, I think. There was one other question I had for us, but I wonder if we want to take just like one question from the audience. Does anybody out there have something they want to ask us?
Can you give an example of a game that was rejected because it was too crazy?
No. Craziness is not... first off, I would say that we didn't reject per se, right? This actually, nobody submits to this curation here. We all generated ideas about what might fit and then sort of whittled them away. And we tried to be very broad in where we generated ideas from. We took them from anywhere, anything that might fit. But craziness is certainly not a criteria, I think, that we looked at either way. We didn't say to ourselves, everything's got to be really wacky. But we also didn't say, like, well, that's too far out there.
There were some things that did come up that we simply could not have. That because they either were couldn't be played in like a single session of that the story. I can't remember the name. But there was also stuff that was just out of impracticality. It couldn't be at the museum. Or it couldn't be brought here, like Magnesia.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say that the criteria that ended up removing things had a lot to do with what was going to work in the space, where were we going to be able to bring developers to. It's really important to us to try and have developers come with games. They get a lot of value from watching the general public play their games. And also the general public finds, I think, more value in playing a very new experience when they can talk to the designer about it, who's right there. And then, yeah, some things were not installable in this space in a realistic way or are not playable by a museum audience that's likely to spend 5 or 10 minutes at a specific game and then move on. And I think that ended up being a lot of the shape that we used to whittle away at first.
Yeah, we had to work around the fact that, I mean, it was in a museum, so we had to really, you know, kind of respect that. But one of the games we did want to bring, but couldn't, is a game called Planet Liquor. It uses frozen fruit juice, and, like, you're supposed to play by kind of, like, eating it. But they have to bring in, like, dry ice, and there's like logistical things that, like, as much as we would have loved to have it, just realistically, it just seemed kind of difficult for both the developers and the museum to be able to manage.
This isn't related to this Indicate East, but I did have to one time reject someone who wanted to bring a hot tub, which would have been amazing.
Yeah.
But just would be possible with an infinite budget, but just the practical reasons of that I had to turn it down.
There's a bunch of crazy stuff with hot tubs. The floor that you put a hot tub on has to be able to support a massive amount of weight. A friend of mine tried to put one on his roof, and the contractor was like, no.
Oh.
He's like, this hot tub will be in your bedroom tomorrow. I think we got a couple minutes left. We got another question. More?
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting question. I think Replicable made its way in there because we were really looking at this idea of design through affordance and interface, and we wanted that to be something where, as a broad, lots of people moved through, they could talk about, oh, when I used that wobbly controller, it made me feel this way, and that would generate those kinds of conversations. And to me, that's what I would do. If that statement was different, I would be thinking about a different conversation that I wanted the audience to have. I would start from that conversation. So if that statement was like totally irreplicable, everybody's experience is unique, we would start from what are experiences and games and ideas that we could bring into this space where everybody's going to have a different way that they saw it, in a different way, and how can we afford for them to talk about those, and how can we find experiences, and this is in the end not too different from what we did, how can we find experiences that fit in the space, that it's capable for us to program into the space, that will then work that way with the audience that's present there. And I actually think that last thing's super important. It's come up a bunch, but right, like, different audiences are going to come to different spaces, and understanding who that audience is, what they're looking for, what their preconceptions are, and how they're going to approach each piece is a huge part of them picking the pieces that help you provoke the experience that you want. Does that sort of answer the question? Yeah. Other people, I'm sure, have cool things to say.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I feel like we've probably talked at length about this, and I think about it a lot, too. I mean, I mean, the first thing to say is I think it sort of brings up this question of the economic models of games, and thinking about about games as, are they cultural products, mm-hmm. or are they, you know, works of art? And obviously they're not mutually exclusive, but it's like, what is that spectrum? And thinking about, you know, this, the Marxist in me, but like, you know, what is the effect of how like economic markets change or affect how you make things? So right, I think what we did here was very much about that tension of there are people who want to make these really interesting things, but they're sort of having to think about how do we also make it possible for more people to play, whether for economic reasons or for practical reasons or whatever. You know, and this idea of like games that evolve or change or that are different, that also brings this idea of like theater and how, you know, what's the relationship between games and theater. And then also like from a sort of museum, like long-term, long-vision perspective, what does it mean to present something to an audience that changes over time but has the same title or is the same work? I think like lots of museums, you know, think about, you know, you have an exhibition that's open for 3 or 4 months and you want to create, you know, you want sort of many people to be able to come and see the thing that you're doing. So what does it mean when something is changing over time? And is it the museum's role to, you know, to be presenting that. Maybe that's a different role in a different context for...
How do you establish that contract with that audience,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think the understood contract with the museum is that if Jason goes to a museum and says, oh, there's this exhibit there, and this piece is amazing, and it moved me like this, then I'm going to hear that, and if I'm interested in being moved that way, I'm going to go. And what does it mean if we have that based on that my understanding of what a museum is, and then I go and I have a very different, I'm presented with something that's very different than what Jason described to me.
Yeah, I'm working on something right now that's like thinking about how to present performances that happened on Facebook, you know, or on. I'm also thinking about how to create an exhibit about Snapchat or about sort of ephemeral media. Like, how the hell do you do that? Like, fundamentally, those like the intention of the museum and intention of Snapchat is
12-year-olds in clear boxes and they just Snapchat at each other while we watch.
Right. I mean, right. How do you do that? I mean, that's like. Yeah, I think sort of like the logical end of sort of that question. So I don't know. I mean, those are really interesting questions that I think about all the time. We can talk more.
Brian, GJ, do you guys have anything to add about that?
I think it's kind of what I thought was really interesting is a lot of these games, like some of them are flying in from like showing at PAX or GDC, and it's a different kind of context when they're showing these kind of games. Because a lot of them, they're either like not easily marketable or very difficult to be marketable. But placing them in the museum, like, it feels like it makes sense. Because I don't know how to, like word it as best as I can. But, like, it seems to make sense in a museum because it's in a space where, like, general audiences can just come in and watch. And there's no expectation of, like, they're here to make money off this, like, product. Sorry to call it a product. But, like, product. They're here to showcase their work as it is without any of that, like, baggage attached to it, and I think it's more honest that way. I don't know. I'm like really trying to be careful with how I'm wording things to not like offend people. But
I should do a better job of that.
Yeah, I don't know. It just feels more honest and genuine as like as a creator.
That's a good note.
Yeah, and that's like 12:05, so we already took
extra
minutes of your time. No. This is not. Yeah, this is my fault. Thank you all for coming and hearing us talk about that. I hope those of you who haven't explored everything on the third floor yet will do so today. And in general, just I hope you're enjoying Indicate East here at the Museum of the Moving Image.
Thank you,
Brian and GJ. It was such a pleasure to work with you on this.
Thank
and
you,
Jason,
thank
it
you.
Is always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to us, Blab.
Yay!
Thank you.